This is a Thinking Aloud podcast from the BBC, and for more details on our terms of use and much, much more about Thinking Aloud, go to our website at bbc.co.uk. Hello. 20 years ago or so, I was ridiculously proud of my thick, black, curly hair and my heavy-framed spectacles. I like to think that the combination made me look, well, like a libertarian philosopher. That was until the night when, in the face of good advice, I walked into an overcrowded Glasgow pub and ordered a pint of heavy. And even as I was taking my first sip, I found myself being forcibly addressed by a man leaning on the bar next to me. "You're Rolf Harris," he said. "I'm so sorry," I said. "You're Rolf Harris." "I'm so sorry." "You're Rolf Harris." I could tell that my number was up. "Yes, yes, yes," I said, rapidly finishing my pint and looking to the exit. "I'm Rolf Harris." Well, nobody was better at capturing such moments of public embarrassment, I reckon, than comedian Al Reed. He had a wonderful sketch with a rather similar drunk addressing passengers on a bus. "Have I offended you? Have I offended you?" Do you remember? Anyone remember that? Now, we all naturally hope to avoid any such embarrassing and demeaning occasions, but if we believe what we read about the increasing lack of respect for others in British society, we might well expect to be increasingly subject to incivilities, to become victims of rudeness. And that was certainly the expectation of Philip Smith and his fellow researchers, Timothy Phillips and Ryan King, when they set up their extensive survey into rudeness, a study which they based in Sydney, Australia, and is now published in a book under the title Incivility, the Rude Stranger in Everyday Life. When I spoke earlier to Philip Smith, who's Professor of Sociology at Yale University, I began by asking about the range of the behaviour he studied.
Well, it covers a wide number of things, ranging from very minor things that might happen to you in everyday life, such as somebody bumping into you or blocking your line of sight, through to more serious things, such as a burnt-out car on your corner block or some threatening youths hanging out on the street corner. And this has been a little bit of a problem, that our research has tended to focus on the more serious dimensions of incivility rather than the trivial things which we might think of as rude behaviour. My feeling is that because of political agendas and also the direction of criminology in taking over this research field, small-scale everyday activities have been somewhat neglected. But these are really what's important to people in everyday life, little things that annoy you or irritate you or which can spoil your day, but which aren't necessarily threatening or dangerous.
It's interesting, isn't it, that recently a new significance has been given to all sorts of forms of antisocial behaviour. Could you just expand on that?
Well, I think politicians often look for an easy way to identify a problematic group. And rude people, who are usually defined as minority kids or teenagers hanging out in hoodies, provide a kind of soft target for them that's easy to rant and rail about how they're bringing social problems in their wake.
Well, I mean, what we get, don't we? We have the ideas of zero tolerance, or in this country, Tony Blair's respect agenda. The notion that quite small acts of antisocial behaviour can have big implications for the whole of society.
The idea of zero tolerance policing, for example, came out of the broken windows hypothesis of Kelling and Wilson, which was launched way back in the 1980s. And behind this was a whole narrative which suggested that respectable middle-class people would bail out of problematic neighbourhoods when they saw small signs of disorder, such as even trivial things like skateboarding or chewing gum on the pavement. And this whole narrative really took over in urban planning and criminology because it suggested there was a cheap or quick fix to things that really required major structural adjustments, such as spending on education or physical infrastructure. Politicians found this also appealing because it offered them a picture of a society that needed mending, and of course they were the people who would do the mending.
So your research, the focus of your research, differed in a way from previous research, I think in two main ways, because you decided not to focus upon what one might call deprived areas or upon the underclass, but upon the general population. And also you decided not to study home, residential areas, but to study people on the move. Can you just explain why you took those two turns?
OK, well, we have to think about the direction of most of the research on criminology on rudeness. And what basically happened was that, inspired by broken windows and similar theories, these started to look at the poorest areas. And then there was an issue of methodological convenience, which was that researchers with clipboards could walk around coding things like burnt-out cars or graffiti. They could then correlate this with census data, which is collected on a residential basis, and with police crime reports. And the whole image that you got was that incivility was all about where people lived. So we decided to try to broaden the scope of the research on rudeness and to cover everything, including typical middle-class experiences in prosperous neighbourhoods. On top of this, the problem was that they were coding physical stuff in the landscape, but not interpersonal interactions. But when you think about your rude encounters in everyday life, most of these involve actual other people with whom you have some kind of an encounter.
What was the most surprising thing about the findings? What made you think, just a minute, we're onto something new here? This seems to differ from what we've been heard from previous surveys into incivility.
Well, I think the surprise really came for us during the focus group phase, in which we went out and just talked to people in groups and said, what's happened to you recently? And I think we as researchers had been conditioned by the criminological literature and to a little extent by political statements as well into the belief that rudeness was something that happened primarily in marginal areas and was propagated by young people who were deliberately rude. But when we talked to people in our focus groups, they just came up with incredibly trivial incidents that took place in everyday locations, such as the supermarket, the car park, or the railway station.
The things you're talking about are pushing, swearing, bumping, prejudice comments, people using mobile phones. That's pretty well the list, isn't it?
The list is quite extensive. I think what I'd like to get across to you is the fact that most of the rude activities were unintentional, and they consisted of people trying to move through physical space. So the majority category was blocked movement, bumping, an invasion of lines of sight. For example, one of our stories involved a blocked line of sight at the ice cream freezer in the supermarket. The issues such as bad language and noise were less common than we expected. We'd expected higher levels of sexist and racist comments and swearing directed at innocent people, but most of the activity seemed to be unintentional activities related to trying to move through urban environments.
I mean, you found, I think, that a third of the people you interviewed had experienced an incident of incivility in the past few weeks. But as you say, 60% of this is about space and movement.
Yeah, absolutely. The issue with rudeness, I think, is we tend to think of it as a question of personalities and that there are people out there who are rude by nature and who go around being horrible to others. But what seems to be going on is that rudeness is generated by situations in which perfectly normal, well-adjusted people bump into, push against, or block the line of sight of other normal, well-adjusted people. A good predictor is a crowded location in which people are moving at different speeds and on various trajectories. So if you think about a motorway, or what we call a freeway in the States, there's a large amount of kinetic force moving down that motorway on any given mile, but the number of accidents is incredibly low. By contrast, a place like Waterloo Station would be a very good location for rudeness. We'd have people moving at different speeds, people wheeling suitcases, and people rushing for trains.
And you say, just to press you a little bit more on this, you say you can't talk about typical culprits. There isn't a stereotype of the rude person in public places. Almost, it's as though everyone can be rude on occasions.
Yeah, correct. With Tony Blair's Respect Agenda, he conjures up a person spitting at an old lady on her way to the bus stop in his speech. And when you hear that image, something immediately comes to your mind, and I prepare to bet it will come to the mind of most of your listeners, which is that the person who does the spitting is A, not female, B, is not also an old woman, and C, is not respectable. But when we actually did this research and we asked people who was rude to you, it turns out that two-thirds of the rude people were male, but many of them were middle-aged, and the vast majority were respectable. So if you think about a typical politician from the front bench of one of our parties, the rude stranger would look something like them, something like Mr. Cameron or Mr. Clegg.
So people who are rude to us are quite likely to be socially similar to ourselves.
Yeah, this is one of our more interesting findings, that we found that there tended to be social similarity, and this has something to do with daily routine. So when you're in the city, you move around, and the places you go to are often ones where people who are socially similar to you will also go. Rudeness that took place at destinations in particular involved people in similar demographics. So a nightclub will tend to consist of people aged under, say, 25 or 30. The places where the rude stranger was different from the victim were tending to be places that were on transport trajectories or transport nodes. These are places where different social groups come together and then split apart as they move to destinations.
What I was very interested in, what might be called the coping strategies of those people who were, let's call them, the victim of these events, because it was quite remarkable how many of them got over such matters relatively quickly.
Exactly, yeah. We put in a battery of items there asking people what they did to cope with the rude encounter. This included things such as trying to think about the event in a different way, or sitting and waiting for your feelings to pass. And these tended to be the most common responses. We also put in options for people to say they'd hit objects, had a drink, or taken some pills. And these weren't very popular at all. Most people seemed to be sensible, and they just waited for things to calm down.
They almost were saying to themselves, well, look, this is what you have to expect in a contemporary city. This is going to go on, so let's get it over and get on with the rest of our life. That was the type of thing they said to themselves.
Yeah, we believe that's the case, that people know that if they brood on these events, they're just going to have a day that's more miserable. And if you want to spoil someone's day, you give them something that they'll chew over and feel resentful about. In this case, people thought, on the basis of their past experience, I'm not going to let this get to me. I'm going to wait till I've cooled down. And I'm not going to make things worse by feeling angry.
And I suppose an important factor in being able to take that attitude was the other finding that 70% of your respondents thought that the rudeness they'd experienced was unintentional. So it was not, if you like, directed personally at them. So therefore, it was more readily, if you like, laid to rest.
Yeah, I think that's right. People had to think of a reason why this took place. And if they could think of a reason, then it helps people to deal with coping. This unintentionality, actually, is an interesting finding. About 70% of the events, people said, were the rude stranger acting in their own interests, but not setting out to be intentionally rude. They're just focused on the ice cream cabinet, focused on getting to their train or changing lanes in their car.
And in a way, your book, this is why I welcomed your book, because it seemed to me to provide a sort of corrective to the more pessimistic reading of public behaviour, the type of thing that you find in books by, like, Zygmunt Bauman or Putnam, which seem to see a complete deterioration, if you like, in our social fabric. We have groups of people wandering around in an alienated, distrustful, fearful way around our cities. But your book doesn't read like that, does it?
No, I think the picture we had in the end was of people as creative and pragmatic. It's rather like the picture you get in the early works of Irving Goffman, who studied the artful and creative ways that people got through life and made accommodations to each other. And while we're talking about fear, which you just mentioned, we did ask people after the event whether they'd changed their routines, become more aversive or hardened against civil interaction. Most people said they weren't going to change anything they did, and many actually said that they were going to become more civil and try to be nicer to people in future, which is a very encouraging result.
I was talking there to Philip Smith. Doesn't that make you feel much better about life, about your journey to work this morning? Now, if you listened to last week's programme, you'll remember that I had to apologise to my guest, John Thompson, for not having enough time to discuss the value of literary agents in the 21st century publishing business. Well, let me partly remedy that deficiency now with this little single sentence from John's book, Merchants of Culture. He writes, "The value of the agent is not simply that they provide the initial filter that selects some authors and books and screens out others. The very fact that they are supporting the book and the way that they support it when they are sounding out the editor's interest on the telephone or over lunch and when they send the proposal or manuscript with a cover, letter or email are vital contributions to the web of collective belief." Well, it was, however, non-contributing agents which most absorbed listeners to that interview. Here's Rosemary Blaise describing her experience of commissioning scripts from eager and hungry writers. She says, "Their agents were never available, constantly in Frankfurt, probably in the airport, with nowhere to go. It's beyond me how the book publishing business and writers have survived with them." Others, like Leslie Henry and Emma Quow, were surprised that we had not mentioned the role played by the 1998 abolition of the Net Book Agreement in the development of bookshop chains and the decline of independent sellers. It wasn't the new bookshop chains, however, which concerned Ellen Stein, but the arrival of the new megalomaniac publishers. Laurie, I was commissioned to write a non-fiction book by a distinguished old-school independent publishing house. However, by the time I delivered, they had been acquired by a media conglomerate, and my book fell victim to a mass cull of forthcoming mid-list titles. According to an in-house editor, the editorial team liked it, but the marketing department found it, and this, Laurie, is a direct quote, too thoughtful. Well, quite right, too. I mean, we don't want anything too thoughtful interfering with our normal reading patterns, do we? Just time to thank those like Henry Gilrose, Alex Corley and Andrew Berechitz, who emailed to express varying degrees of concern about the dramatically increased use of solitary confinement in American prisons. Very reassuring. In case you've got any comments on today's discussions, here are our addresses. Thinking Aloud, BBC Radio 4, Broadcasting House, London, W1A, 1AA, or you can email us at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. And don't forget, if you'd like to hear the programme again, sign up for my newsletter. This week, could you please stand up and let an elderly person sit down? Consult our extensive archive or download our podcast. All you've got to do is go to this website and click through. bbc.co.uk/radio4. Ah, there you are. Welcome to my arms store. You're looking for a gun? Well, perhaps I could recommend this one. It's a rather strange-looking rifle, yeah, but it's shorter than the standard infantry rifle, but it's longer than a submachine gun, and it uses a medium-sized cartridge. It's not powerful enough for long sniping duty, but it's very, very lethal at a more local range. It also has little recoil compared to other rifles, and it rarely jams, even when it's soaked in water and mud. And most crucially, perhaps, its basic operation can be grasped in round about 60 minutes. Say hello to the AK-47, the Kalashnikov. Well, I know all these details so well because I've been reading a new book called The Gun, the AK-47 and the Evolution of War by the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and journalist C.J. Christopher John Chivers. It's a study which examines the quite extraordinary political, cultural and social import of this single weapon. Well, Christopher is now on the line from Washington, here with me in the studio. I'm also joined by Richard Holmes, Professor of Military and Security Studies at Cranfield University. Chris, let me come to you first. Tell me a little bit about the origins of the AK-47. We're all so familiar with the name, but I don't think many people exactly know when it first arrived on the scene.
Well, the immediate roots reached to Hitler's Germany, which fielded the first mass-produced infantry assault rifle for its forces, which used them in the Second World War against Russia. The Soviet troops picked up the weapon and immediately saw its merits. The intelligence service passed it on to the main artillery directorate, which then held a set of processes to first reproduce that medium-powered ammunition you just described, to make a conceptual copy, and then to build an assault rifle around it. That task was given to a constellation of design teams, which over the course of just a few years made several prototypes, which gradually, through a process of winnowing and conversion, became the AK-47. That's interesting in that that title is Avtomat Kalashnikova, which means automatic by Kalashnikov, a particular Russian sergeant who was given credit with the weapon, but it's better understood as coming from this much larger collective design process.
Tell me a little bit about this Kalashnikov, because there's a certain myth, isn't there, which suggests that here was this brilliant inventor who came along and produced this weapon, but there's some mythology involved here.
There's some mythology. There's elements of truth. He was intimately involved, but this much larger sort of Stalinist administration and will and the army bureaucracy made this weapon through an enormous amount of resources. But they had a need besides a weapon. They had a need for heroes. This was, you know, post the purges and at the end of World War II. And there was the Soviet Union had a real dearth of public heroes then. They needed some that were unquestionably subordinate to Stalin. And Kalashnikov sort of fit a mold, like a cosmonaut or a gold medalist. He was an arms designer whose plebeian resume really served the state purposes as being kind of the quintessential Soviet son.
And it's interesting. I mean, you point out, of course, when we're talking about the nuclear arms race and the interesting way in which nuclear arms are not used, but the Kalashnikov becomes enormously used because it was being invented in the Soviet. It was being the intention in the Soviet Union was it would be used for battles involved in the Cold War, wasn't it?
Well, initially it was seen as, you know, the standard shoulder-fired arm to be handed out to this rather sprawling Eastern Bloc forces, kind of like the Lee Enfield of its time. for the Eastern Bloc. But it quickly migrated. I like to see these two weapons, the atomic bomb and the nuclear program, if you will, and the conventional programs that led to the AK-47, as kind of a faded pair. You know, one fixed borders in place, and the other became the instrument that would actually be used in conflicts, both locally and abroad.
It's odd because we don't usually associate the Soviet Union with technical, the sort of technical expertise, with the invention of technical solutions. You say that this really was a rather rare thing. If they'd done the same thing with cars or anything like that, they'd have conquered the world.
Well, you wouldn't want to wear a Soviet pacemaker, would you? the things that they wanted to make, the planned economy was broadly, of course, inefficient. But the things they wanted to make, they could make quite well. They make a wonderful tank, a very good rifle, an excellent helicopter. You know, the escalators are really just metal staircases, aren't they? The elevators don't work. But the rifles did.
Let me bring in Richard Holmes now. Richard, I mean, you've written about weapons and history. You've made very many television programs in which you've talked about the role of weapons in history. What about the Kalashnikov? I mean, how does it rate technically? You fired it.
Well, it doesn't necessarily rate technically terribly high, but that's not the issue. I mean, here is a weapon which is simple. Designed for Eastern Bloc conscripts, which may not be the apogee of technology, but works and works well under lots of circumstances. So it's turned out to be the weapon which has, I think, decisively reduced that asymmetry that you often got traditionally between the insurgent who was badly equipped and the counterinsurgency power, who were well-equipped. Well, in a sense, but only in a sense, the AKs reverse that great truth.
I mean, it is fascinating to me to read a book which takes the presence of a weapon and then studies the ways in which that weapon altered the course of history. I mean, going back into military history, can you think of any other weapons which had a similar effect?
Goodness, I mean, there have been great iconic weapons. There was the longbow, English Welsh longbow. It has a huge effect on medieval warfare, but it was an artisan weapon. I mean, it was difficult to make and very difficult to use, so its effect was limited. The Brown Bess musket similarly dominates Napoleonic battlefields, but never caught on in quite the same way. I think the AK is the most extreme example of this world-changing simple weapon.
Chris, coming back, tell me a little bit about how the gun moved out of the Soviet Union, how it sort of spread around the world, how it got out of control, if you like.
Well, Richard's really nailed it as terms of having this weapon having this effect as a battlefield leveler, and that comes from two processes. One is the qualities of the weapon itself. Then the other is something else. It's the qualities of the system that made it. This weapon was made in the planned economy. It wasn't made by the order, if you will. You know, if a consumer wanted 1,000 rifles for a battalion, the typical arms plant would make 1,000 rifles. The planned economy made these rifles in extraordinarily outsized quantities and stockpiled them. Once these weapons...
What sort of numbers are we talking about, Chris?
We're into the tens of the millions. No one exactly knows, but it's an extraordinary number. I mean, at first, you know, this weapon was franchised out by the Kremlin to China, to North Korea, to Egypt, throughout the Eastern Bloc and every of the Eastern Bloc countries except for the Czechs.
So in that respect, they were seeing it as almost a weapon of liberation. I mean, they saw it as advancing the revolution in other countries.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I think they first saw it as the weapon of standardization to bring everyone onto one piece of equipment across all of these different language and cultural barriers. What happened was once enough quantities of them were made, and it's the great irony here, is that the planned economy made them, and it was the market economy that helped move them. Once they existed, it was only a matter of time before their effect would be held. And then those qualities that Richard described then kicked in. It turned out once it was out in the field, everybody realized, my God, this thing is so simple to use and so long-lasting and so effective in such a range of circumstances. So these two things came together, the qualities of the weapon and the qualities of the system. and gave it the influence that this weapon has had.
And of course, as it moved into the hands, Richard, as it moved into the hands of terrorists and insurgents of various sorts, that this is when it begins to develop its iconic status, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still a thing. I mean, look at the iconography of the AK-47. Look at the way that it appears in all sorts of images, in banners and flags. It's the sort of thing if you want to make the point, if you want to be a freedom fighter, yeah, right on. Here's my AK-47. It has this extraordinary force, not simply as a weapon, but as an image as well.
And if you have an Al Qaeda video, you need to have one in the background showing it.
Oh, you do indeed. And if you're an Al Qaeda leader and you want to demonstrate that you've got street cred, well, ensure that your weapon is to hand, that it's popped up beside you, because you're not simply a propagandist. You're a fighting man as well, and you have the tools of the trade ready to hand.
Even if you're a rap artist in America, I mean, to have one of these on display or on your cover of your CD or whatever helps.
Yeah, it does, indeed.
I want to talk about... Do we really need to talk about very large numbers of people having suffered terrible deaths as a result of the proliferation of this weapon? I mean, might not they have been killed in some other ways? I mean, to what extent, Chris, can we say the AK-47 is responsible for millions of deaths simply by the fact of its material existence?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about the rifle or the quantity of the rifles. The individual rifle, I mean, I can't imagine a better reason to make a rifle than those that faced the Soviet Union in the 1940s. They had a very rational reason to arm themselves as they did, having just suffered what they suffered in the Great Patriotic War. It's one thing, however, to arm an army and its reserves and to have a reasonable amount of weapons stockpiled. It's another to have this extraordinary quantity of weapons. And when the quantity got out, I would argue, and I think most people would probably agree, that once it reached large numbers of hands in relatively lawless places, some of those places essentially went off the grid in terms of public services and human security.
But it is, isn't it? I mean, Richard, I mean, how do you get rid of arms? I mean, okay, we say that it's the enormous number of these which are available and are around all the world, but I mean, is it possible to decommission? Have there been any successful stories where you can decommission a particular weapon?
Well, you can't. The real problem here is that you can't decommission millions of AKs. You can't decommission millions of AKs. I mean, places like Africa are awash with them. And it's so simple and it's so light that, in a sense, it makes child soldiers possible in a way that I think they wouldn't be without the AK.
That's a fascinating story. Thank you very much. Thank you, Christopher Chivers in Washington and Richard Holmes here in London. Thank you both. Well, I do hope you enjoyed that programme. And if you'd like to hear something similar, why not try downloading the In Our Time podcast at bbc.co.uk/radio4.